and is largely rooted in right-wing dehumanization of Muslims as a foreign invader. In reality, the roles are flipped. Muslim leaders and activists are raising alarm bells of establishment-backed efforts to infiltrate and change the Muslim community from within. Here are a few noteworthy examples. In Britain, huge support is given to promote and platform a group known as the Qadianis, or sometimes by their preferred name, the Ahmadiyya. The group's claims of being an Islamic sect is heavily supported by the British establishment and cemented with English news reports claiming the same. However, this group is routinely condemned by Muslims worldwide for their heretical beliefs, including a belief in prophets after the final messenger, Muhammad, peace be upon him. The Muslim world considers the Qadianis as a heretical cult backed by the British to further their imperialist interests. Their propaganda is said to cause significant damage to the Dawah, spreading false ideas under the name of Islam. For Shia Muslims, the concept of British Shia and American Sunnis has been warned against by some of the Shia world's highest authorities. Radical preachers based in the West who spread sectarian views or narratives with the purpose of sowing conflict and fitna across the Muslim world has been compared to historical imperialist tactics of divide and rule. Other examples could include the self-described Muslims who enter into secular politics, using their Muslim heritage to score votes, but endlessly contradicting Islamic principles when it counts. In some cases, these self-described Muslim politicians support policies including Western aggression on the Muslim world or that criminalize Muslims living in the West.
Well, joining us today in the studio to talk about these very concerning issues, we have two esteemed guests. Sayed Mohsen Abbas is a TV producer, broadcaster, presenter, and journalist based here in Britain. And Raza Kazim is a human rights activist, political analyst, teacher, and presenter as well. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you as always. Sayed Mohsen, I'm going to come to you first because you're very familiar with these groups that were mentioned among those are just a few examples. Just tell us, why are they a real danger? What problems can they cause for the Ummah?
Well, first of all, I think to give it context, you have to understand the objectives of those people who are looking to use these groups against Muslims themselves. So that's primarily the neoliberal, neoconservative, Zio-Western imperialist power. That's who really stands to benefit from playing any games within the Muslim world. And they stand to gain basically the securitization of their own interests, plunder political and military in those regions. So divide and rule is a well-known old tactic, and this is no different. What you find is that once the Islamic Revolution occurred, because this is the root of the real current contemporary issue that's going on around sectarianism and these issues. So the Islamic Revolution leads to a response from Israel, from the Zionists, from, of course, the British establishment and the American establishment, which kowtows to them. And it leads to coming up with strategies like launching entire wars against them through Saddam Hussein. And cut to the chase, around 9/11, they come up with their ultimate policy to go and literally start invading every country in that region, from Iraq to Afghanistan to Libya. All of it has gone down because of, I think, their fear of the Islamic Revolution and the resistance that's rising in that region, which threatens their economic and other interests. So one of the classic tactics in soft power is to infiltrate the enemy, in this case, the Muslims for them, and to find their vulnerable points, their weaknesses. And the British especially are exceedingly good at this. They have intelligence from back in the 19th century, 18th century onwards, they've been doing this kind of thing, and they have the intel on the Muslim world. So they're the ones who I think led very much in terms of coming up with this notion of creating your own Islamic groups or favoring certain groups in order to break the natural push that was coming from the Islamic Revolution, the ideals of political autonomy, sovereignty, independence, those notions of liberty for Muslims and for them to take hold of their own lands rather than being ruled by post-colonial imperialists. This is what the real game was about. And they nurtured, for instance, Salafism, Wahhabism. That was their first game. The Saudis were initiated back in the 70s to launch a huge amount of finance into the business of sectarianizing the Muslim community. And rather latterly, of course, they've got their fingers in the pie even with the Shia communities around the world, because what they don't want is they don't want a united Shia Marjiyat under the Marjiyat, or let alone under the auspices of Ayatollah Khamenei. They don't want a kind of an Islam rising in Britain which is truly political and wants justice and is against those kind of plunder, looting, and kind of manipulation, divide and rule policies. So, of course, what do? You go and find the most vulnerable people within the Shia communities. You offer them money. You enroll them into your sort of educational systems. Offer them career incentives. Pay direct cash, or simply find the ones who are naturally in a problem with the Islamic Revolution or the Iranian establishment, and you start buying them into your agenda. And that's exactly what's happened.
I think Mohsen mentioned very accurately that historically Britain has been known for using a divide-and-rule strategy to rule over its conquered regions as part of the empire. But the empire is actually gone now. So why is it that groups like the Qadianis, which have a huge temple, whatever you want to call it, in London, and a lot of support, other radical preachers seem to be given special status here to preach their hate in the UK. Why is Britain persisting with this strategy today when the empire as we knew it has basically crumbled now?
I think if I can quote Winston Churchill, the ex-Prime Minister of Britain, he said the empires of the future are the empires of the mind. And I think also Steve Biko, in contrast, South African activist who was killed by the apartheid regime, actually said the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. And I think that's one of the things that we really need to think about in terms of how things are actually going. And following on from what Mohsen has actually said in how this is playing itself out within the, when you talk about British Shiism or American British Shia Islam and American Sunni Islam, these are concepts and they're not necessarily limited to those geographical areas, although we can really see people who are within the British system actually pandering to this sectarianism. What's his face, the sectarian scumbag who sits on the members and, the Simon Cowell wannabe. He's trying to push that kind of agenda. We also see within the American Sunni concept, even within Britain, there's some of that where you've got Muslim news organizations platforming some of the takfiris who are allowed to do takfir against the Shia. So we've got that whole spectrum of things actually going on, which are a real problem. You've also got this idea that you've got to normalize, again, following on from what Sayyid Mohsen has said about normalizing the proponents of Zionism within the Muslim community. So that they come on the TV channels, they come on the community centers, where the opposite would not work. If you had people who were going to perhaps speak up for Palestine or something like that, they wouldn't have any of that actually going on. So you've got that normalization actually taking place. The other aspect is this idea of depoliticizing Muslims, depoliticizing Muslim spaces and depoliticizing Islamic centers, so that anything that is of sociological concern, sociopolitical concern, of political concern, where there's oppression going on, where there's racism going on, where there's injustice going on, where, as we feel that, one of our concepts of Islam is this idea of having justice, fighting against oppression, standing for the oppressed, and all of those things is very central and core to who we are as Muslims. And that idea of depoliticization is something that is very much part and parcel of what's actually going on. And there is an attempt to actually social engineer what kind of Islam you would have. So the idea is not to shut down centers or Muslims, but to actually, you know, following on from what Sayyid Mohsin has said, is actually taking things in a direction that will be beneficial for the state. So you would have the buffet service that the you know, the British establishment would actually want Muslims. Okay, you can have this, this, and this, but this is not going to be part of what's available on this menu.
For sure. Now, before we cut to the next wise words of wisdom, which we're going to play out shortly, let me just very briefly ask you, Sayyid. I guess could you just list the problems? So we've got radical speakers who spread sectarian ideas. They're getting support here. We've got groups that are undermining traditional Islamic beliefs, like belief in other prophets after the prophet. And then we also have, what else? There's like politicians who represent Muslims, apparently, but then they undermine Muslims. There's so many examples here.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think from the secular angle, there are people who would call themselves secular Muslims. So they will do anything to conform with whatever secular, neoliberal, muscular neoliberalism wants them to. They have no concern about standing up for justice or being anti-oppression. They're just happy with the pie they have, living in the West, and absolutely grateful for the Queen. Well, it's the King now, isn't it? And the establishment to continue giving them the abundance and plenty which keeps their mouths shut, basically. Then you've got, of course, the religious fundamentalists, as the media here likes to put it, but basically the Wahhabist Takfiris or the Qadianis, all those people in one way, shape or form all conform to this agenda of splitting and dividing. The Qadianis do it in a different way. They've always traditionally been very much tucked in as the alternative to real Islam. They were, in British India, along with the Brelvis and many others, part of the movement to suppress the mutiny, suppress Indian independence when it rose up in 1857, when there was a genuine uprising. It was these kinds of forces, which were all manipulated by the British as sectarian groups, to praise the establishment, to suppress any notion of mutiny and revolution. So we're seeing the same thing being done again now. The same groups, the same kind of insipid brown noses of establishment coming and doing exactly what they've done historically. It's really almost, if you go and look at Indian history, you'll see all of this being played out already there.
And they're all here in the UK, coincidentally, including Yasser Habib, another hate preacher who was, I think he was jailed at one point in Kuwait. Now he's ended up here. He's got his own TV station. It seems like some coincidence, doesn't it? Let me just ask you about this specific point, the one he made about British Shia and American Sunni. He explained that, you know, he's not talking about Muslims living here. He's talking about bootlickers, essentially, Western-backed Muslims who are undermining traditional Islam, undermining the power of the Ummah, basically. So perhaps, again, you could just emphasize this point to our audience. How dangerous is this, and what danger could it have from here, even over in the Muslim world as well?
I think it's like this term that was said about Gufis who betrayed Imam Hussein at the time of Karbala and so on and so forth. It's that same kind of idea that you've got British Shias, you've got American Sunnis, and the idea is to actually say quite clearly that you are depoliticizing, disempowering Muslims to be able to say what is the right thing to say, to stand up against oppression, to say things at the time that the British state wants you to say certain things and not say other things because the British state at that point in time doesn't want you to say those things, to encourage sectarianism within the Muslim community from both angles, from both sides, to actually promote hatred between the Muslims. So when you've got Muslims fighting amongst each other, then you will not have them fighting against the oppression and for standing for the oppressed.
That's the danger of fitna, basically. That's what this is. This
absolutely.
This is a fitna coming.
And it's something that is about social engineering, a specific type of Islam where you'll have someone who is looking like a Muslim, doing everything, you know, like Imam Khamenei said, in their personal affairs, is doing everything that a good Muslim should be doing, and yet they are disempowered from actually saying, standing up for at a community level, the concept of Ummah, that we're not just individuals, we are a part of a community that is supposed to stand up for justice, and so on and so forth. And disempowering them here and abroad, and using the people here to actually influence what goes on abroad, Going into those communities, we've seen there's evidence, money trails and so on, of how people have actually gone in and influenced the direction of where a Muslim community abroad is going to go and what they're actually going to do. So I think this is something that needs to be guarded against.
For sure. And I think I understand more so now, Sayyid Mohsin, about the whole concept of, you know, I can say I'm a British Muslim because I'm a Muslim living in Britain and I'm British by nationality. But to say I follow British Islam, that's really dodgy, isn't it? I mean, you know, Islam is Islam. And I look to the Middle East and the homeland of Islam, proper scholars about this. I don't look to the British royal family who give a few occasional quotes from the Quran as if they're an authority of the British government. You know, we have to be clear here. You know, I can be a Muslim living in Britain, but we follow Islam, and Islam comes from the Quran at the end of the day.
And not be taken in, if I can come in, or this concept that Prince Charles, as he was then, said defender of the faiths, to somehow make himself out to be in that kind of
mold.
Yeah,
he's no defender of my faith at all, is he?
I think that there is a very subtle trick being played. You see, the new generation that's coming up, they haven't grown up in the countries back home. They don't have the same sort of routines. Many of them don't know about the political situations in those countries either. That's the reality. And what the Western establishment is trying to do with the Muslims here is the same thing they've done with Christianity. So if you look at Christianity as a parallel to this, they've totally depoliticized Christianity. There's no fight for justice or anti-oppression movement you discernibly see coming from the church or the church establishment or any formal establishment. You'll see them cornered into doing social work or welfare work or helping people in kind of vague ways, but never to do with justice, political justice, or social justice on the big stage. So they've basically turned Christianity into a kind of a political eunuch, essentially.
Yes.
And
so
that's what they
defeated
want.
Defeated force, basically.
Basically.
Defeated force, no following.
No following of that kind, and no ability to give them the direction that they require. The Pope himself fails, let alone the Church of England. None of them have the ability or the inclination, actually, because they're all part of the same establishment. That's the reality. So the Muslims are now gradually being herded and regimented into this same process of trying to create a kind of an Islam which is conforming to British policy at every stage. And that's a problem because it will also mean that tomorrow, you know, if there's a war on Syria, and they literally did, you know, if there's a war in Afghanistan, a war in Libya, here the population is currently maybe 6 million Muslims. Another 15, 20 years, that's likely to be 15 or 20 million Muslims. So you can see from a political perspective, to have a set of Muslims who are depoliticized is hugely beneficial for the establishment.
They want to cut the ties between Muslims here and the actual Muslim world, which they're at war with basically most of the time. I think that's the point you're trying to make very, very well. Reza, let me come in because there's another example here which we have to include in the show of where, you know, I think Muslims living in the West can sometimes betray their own community through essentially working with the establishment on, for example, there's an issue with mosques being infiltrated and having non-Muslims installed by the state to manage over them and their charity status. Fill us in on this story and this problem. Make it easy to understand if you can for our audience.
So this is something that the Islamic Human Rights Commission has taken up as a campaign about Save Our Mosques, because it is something that the British state, via the Charity Commission, is actually targeting mosques across the Muslim spectrum and taking them over in appointing interim managers and saying what can and cannot be done. This is in direct violation of the Quranic verse, which clearly states that the people who should be maintaining the mosques should be Muslims and people who are following the Muslim faith, the principles of the Muslim faith, and so on and so forth. I'm paraphrasing that verse, and it's very clear, very very clearly stipulated that non-Muslims or people appointed by a non-Muslim institution cannot be running a mosque, because it will, because first of all, then they are following the agenda of a non-Muslim. They're not following the agenda that is an Islamic agenda, regardless of the sect of Islam that you belong to. And we see that whether it's whatever spectrum of the Muslim community you come from, whether it's Shia, Sunni, it's Barelvi, etc., mosques have been targeted and interim managers appointed. And it is deeply disturbing that this is going on. And one of the things that's happening is the amount of pressure that's being piled onto them. People, trustees, sometimes feel that they have to try and get the mosque open at all costs. And, you know, I'll take the example of the Islamic Center in Maida Vale, which is incidentally linked to Imam Khamenei and so on and so forth. And one of the things that has actually happened there, which is quite, that has been going over the past year, is that there have been Islamophobic attacks and racist attacks against the mosque, where it's been physically damaged. The people inside have been attacked, hurt, and you know, some people from the Muslim community has been hospitalized as a result of the anti-Muslim hatred and rampage that took place across London and ended up at the Islamic Center, and people were, had to be taken to hospital for treatment and so on. So this kind of thing was going on, and and the police weren't doing their job. So people from the Muslim community who were going to this particular place, and in fact others from different parts of the Muslim community, actually came together and said, right, we're going to stand up, and we're going to, if the police aren't going to defend this place, we are. And we stood together, shoulder to shoulder, and said, right, come on, come now, if you dare. And as a result of that, and us pushing back and being prepared to sacrifice, because when those thugs were going to attack, it was going to be physical attacks. We would have had to defend it physically. A lot of those people are professionals who will, as a community, would have lost millions. People who would have lost their livelihoods, people who would have gone and so on and so forth. So I think it's something that people need to recognize in the center, that there were people who were prepared to defend it. And when this takeover happened, it was an insult that the Islamic Center was being taken over by a non-Muslim. And the trustees have capitulated. They've capitulated and allowed this interim manager to run the place and have opened the place of worship instead of resisting. And this is something that is completely unacceptable, because it is against what Rehba would have wanted, and it is something that is in violation of the verse of the Quran.
Sure. It's basically a case of a mosque which the British establishment doesn't like because it's showing independence, and they're now cracking down on it. This is a fantastically interesting story. Unfortunately, we have no time, gentlemen, but we will be talking about this in the future, I assure you, as we have done on other shows. Unfortunately, yes, that is all the time we have for this edition of the show. Thank you to our guests, and thank you at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The European Union's refugee policy goes under the spotlight again in the European Parliament, being branded as illegal under international law and discriminatory. Refugees in European countries say those seeking asylum from Ukraine are receiving preferential treatment. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has covered this story. The European Union has been charged with implementing policies which discriminate between the refugees from Ukraine and those from Asia and Africa. European Union countries, which swiftly and comprehensively mobilized to help Ukrainian refugees following the outbreak of the Russia-Ukraine war in February of 2022, do not show a similar attitude towards those fleeing from other conflict zones, including Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, or conflict zones in Africa. Against this backdrop, numerous migrants froze to death or were pushed back while trying to cross the EU borders. This proves that the bloc violates the principle which entails the provision of humanitarian aid without discrimination. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, is among those who criticize this state of affairs. Filippo Grandi reiterated that black refugees who fled from wars and armed conflicts in Africa do not experience the same welcoming practices offered to their Ukrainian counterparts. Filippo Grandi added, "This is the ugly truth. Moreover, Human Rights Watch highlighted the double standards in Europe in treating refugees from Ukraine and refugees from Syria, Afghanistan, Palestine, and Somalia." It also remarked that Bulgaria, Greece, Spain and Poland continue with their violent policies across their borders against migrants. In response to Anadolu News Agency's questions on the matter, Mohammad Shahada, Commission's director of the Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor, argued that the European Union's discrimination between refugees and migrants is becoming obvious day by day. Mohammad Shahada said, "For example, brutal practices against migrants from Afghanistan, Syria, Palestine and Somalia by countries like Denmark, Bulgaria, Greece and Hungary are overlooked by the European bloc." Mohammad Shahada added, "These practices are even possible with funding from the European Union." British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. According to an official from a global rights group, European countries are closing their doors to those seeking asylum and endangering them by being involved in unlawful and illegal practices. Emily McDonnell, UK Advocacy and Communications Coordinator at Human Rights Watch, says, Many European countries are closing their doors to people seeking their protection and engaging in very harmful, dangerous practices that are non-compliant with human rights laws or refugee laws and put people in grave danger. Emily McDonnell added, sentiments European countries harbour towards refugees were becoming evident and common. She said, there certainly is a wave against migrants, and it is not something that is new, but it's certainly becoming more widespread, more obvious. The British government introduced new legislation against illegal migrants, calling for a ban on those who cross the English Channel by boat to claim asylum in Britain. The legislation also calls for detention of refugees and plans for their removal to their home countries or to Rwanda or any other nations which the UK deems safe. The human rights advocate dubbed the legislation a sweeping bill that strips most asylum seekers of appeal rights, only being able to appeal after they have been removed and sent or expelled to another country, as well as being unable to access Britain's modern slavery protection. Emily McDonnell added, all of this legislation is part of a broader context in Britain, which is that the government is very much demonising and fueling hatred, fear and division against asylum seekers and migrants. She said it would be disastrous and have devastating effect on migrants, particularly people of colour, in the United Kingdom. Emily McDonnell added, the highest number of people crossing the English Channel are those seeking protection from countries like Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Sudan, Eritrea, and places where persecution, wars and human rights abuses are rife. Asylum seekers cannot be returned to those countries as they are not safe. Very limited safe routes exist for individuals who want to arrive in the United Kingdom. Afghans were the highest number of crossing the channel in boats in the last quarter of 2022. But Emily McDonnell said schemes that the government set up for Afghans to travel safely are plagued with problems and not functioning properly. Also, Human Rights Watch has documented the awful and deplorable condition of asylum seekers in encampments, especially in northern France. Emily McDonnell termed the new legislation a breach of the UK's international obligation to the United Nations 1951 Refugee Convention. McDonnell said, it is a flagrant breach of the United Nations Refugee Convention. It is not illegal to seek asylum, and it is irrelevant how a person arrives in the United Kingdom, whether they arrive through a regular route or whether they had to go by boat or in the back of a lorry or by foot. And the government is really fueling this in its rhetoric and stoking divisions. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. The British government has begun a shameful campaign of evicting thousands of Afghan refugees from hotels across Britain. The Afghans, which include families with young children, have been living in the hotels since their rescue from the beleaguered country in 2021. Now all 8,000 living in the so-called bridging hotels have been given notice and will be made to leave Home Office-funded accommodation by the end of August. According to the local government association, one in five who have already been evicted presented as homeless to their local council as they struggle to secure private rentals during the UK's worsening housing crisis. Also, according to recent reports, the number of politically motivated attacks on refugee shelters in Germany has steadily increased since the beginning of last year, with 80 crimes reported in the first half of this year, mostly involving far-right activists. Following a parliamentary inquiry by the radical leftist opposition party, Die Linke, the German government said there are reports of 80 politically motivated crimes in the first half of this year in which a refugee shelter was the scene of the crime or the direct target of an attack. Of these, 74 were allegedly committed by right-wing suspects, with two offences related to the phenomena of foreign ideology. In one instance, the police classified the crime as a religious ideology. In the first half of the year 2022, the police recorded 52 politically motivated crimes against refugee shelters, with an increase of 71 in the second half of the year. According to the German government, 39 people, including 4 children, were injured in crimes committed against asylum seekers, refugees and shelters in the second quarter of 2023. Reacting to the latest figures provided by the government, the spokeswoman for the Left Party on refugee matters, Clara Bunge, called it alarming. Bunge said, "It is alarming that people who seek protection here experience violence, hostility and exclusion so often." She charged the far-right AfD party, as well as the Christian Democratic Union, the CDU, of Germany, and its sister party, the Christian Social Union, the CSU, and with preparing the ground for racist mobilization against refugees through verbal attacks on the right to asylum.
Face to face. In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful. Today, we are in an exclusive interview program with Dr. Safaridi, Deputy for Economic Diplomacy at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Hello, Dr. Safari, and thank you for your presence in this special interview program. If you could please explain the reasons behind Iran's attention to the development of economic and trade relations with Latin American countries, I would appreciate it.
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. You are aware that the 13th government had focused more on its foreign policy towards neighboring countries as its first priority. But we can interpret it as focusing on neighboring countries in addition to Africa and Latin America, because Africa is very important to us. I am only talking about the economic dimensions. The political aspect is separate. So we could work simultaneously with neighboring countries, as well as Africa and Latin America. Among our neighbors are the countries in the Caspian Sea region, as well as Central Asia, and to other countries like Georgia and Armenia, which we consider as our neighbors. All right. In addition to that, we have other target countries such as India, Russia, and China. Russia is our neighbor. And as they say, simultaneously, we started the development work with Africa and Latin America. Regarding Latin America, our priority became the countries that are aligned with us in foreign policy: Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba. Now, whether our relations with them are beneficial to the country or not, I would like to mention one point. Most of our plans, besides the political issues, which can be around 10% to 20%, are focused on our objectives. 80% of the issues are economic. All right? Our aim is to generate revenue for the country. Our exports to those countries, our imports from those countries in terms of necessary goods, and the transfer of our technology and knowledge-based companies that have the ability to export and, alongside that, the ability to transfer technology. So the framework is defined in this way. The export of consumer goods from our country to those other countries, this has been one of our objectives. Second, the import of raw materials, including agricultural and essential goods, as well as mineral commodities. There are many goods in the country that we have, but due to high production, especially in the steel industry, both in the blast furnace and non-blast furnace sectors, we need the necessary raw materials like nickel and copper, etc. This is our objective. All of these are aimed at generating revenue and transferring technology, exporting knowledge-based products. The Supreme Leader emphasized these items in his speech in the new year. All right, so our move towards Venezuela, alongside knowledge-based products, also includes providing engineering services. For example, in Venezuela, in the energy sector, energy includes electricity, oil, gas refineries, and gas pumping stations. We have very good cooperation in this complex, and an important part of it is our provision of engineering services. I won't mention a specific country, but this is part of our objectives, to secure our future markets through the provision of engineering services. So developing new markets alongside maintaining the previous ones. For example, if we had $1 billion in exports to a country, we first need to stabilize that. Last year, it reached $3.2 billion.
Last year?
Yes, in 1401. The first step is $10 billion. The second step is $20 billion. How will this be achieved? We have instead need to be created. Producing means establishing our shipping line, which is logical in creating this line. This work should be continuous. Our rival countries send a ship there every week. If we want to supply our consumer goods, which have a very strong market, we cannot send them every 3 or 4 months irregularly, because someone who goes to the supermarket there relies on our products to be supplied regularly. This is one of the essential things that our airline should take shape there. We have almost 6 or 7 knowledge-based projects contracted there. We have established a technology center there, which is a showcase of our capabilities and power. There is a very good space there for our medical equipment, our medicines, our cancer drugs, not just nanomedicines, but bios. In the neighboring country there, which I won't mention the name, after COVID-19, some countries mostly took advantage of this situation and made a profit, for example, in blood cancer. Now, I don't know what they injected, and I don't want to mention the name. If we have a regular shipping line, they will consume our simple syrups, headache tablets, as well as other simple item products. Has a decision been made on this now? This decision has been made. The president has given the order, and he has given an encouraging order as well. And shipping has promised once every 3 months, but we have requested it to be once a month, and later on, once every 15 days. Well, when our merchants see this space, now they are getting shares in the form of partnership in stores that can supply these goods. So our trade sector, our knowledge-based sector, our technology homes, you see now the Islamic Republic of Iran, when it goes to these countries, they request it as a country. Please rebuild the refinery for us. Sir, we want your knowledge of that specific nanomedicine.
Meaning production in the region?
Yes, both nano and bio. The 4 new sciences in the world, IT, nano, bio, and cognitive. Well, the Islamic Republic of Iran is very good in all 4 of these sciences. The country we visited, Indonesia, also has the same demand. If you remember, in Indonesia, in the presence of 2 presidents, remote robotic surgery was tested up to 500 kilometers. You see which countries have this device. 1 or 2 countries. Well, Indonesia has 3,000 islands where people live. This country is in great need of such a device. Well, its president immediately announced they want to place orders for 14 hospitals in addition to various goods. And therefore, Iran is referred to as a country that has technology. That is, when Iran presents its goods and technology, customers are immediately found worldwide, both in the field of education and technology transfer, and regarding our products. One of the main things that they usually ask is the establishment of technical colleges and the provision of the opportunity for education. Now we're working with several African countries and establishing a technical college. There are many applicants. Exactly the same thing is being done there. Besides this, we had a trip to Nicaragua, and of course, what we do there is on a smaller scale because the population of Nicaragua is smaller. Their demands from Iran included areas such as medicine, technology, trade, nanotechnology, biomedicines, and more. It is the same in the field of energy, and the establishment of power plants. I mean, these requests are always there. There is nothing outside of this framework. These countries enjoy rich mines. For example, we're working on minerals like lead and nickel in Cuba, which are needed for battery factories. We are building a battery factory there in Cuba so that we can have a share in the market. Also, don't forget about aluminum rim. One of the important tasks during the president's visit to Latin America was the revival of projects that had been dormant for 9 years. One of them was tractor manufacturing, which was revived, started, and the factory is producing today. Car manufacturing is also another project. Before that, of course, Saipa and Iran Khodro, two Iranian major auto factories, had sold 3,000 vehicles. These companies actually announced the need, receive the delivery, that is, cars, and then sell them with reasonable prices. This is beneficial for both their ministry and us. This factory was revived for manufacturing autos. We import some parts needed for our industry from other countries for the purpose of producing the cars. In those countries, their Ministry of Industry suggested and introduced some factories to Iranian parts. There is a lot of aluminium bauxite there. The mines are very rich. Our future is in Africa. The future of Iran is in these types of countries. Look, we don't mean to get a PhD in African countries. We just plan to go there to earn money and bring foreign currency to Iran. All the countries of the world go there and take various products to their country, including gold, diamonds, iron ore, copper, nickel, lithium, etc. What economic activity have we done in African countries in the past 40 years? I have always emphasized that our future is there. You must know that in African countries, vehicles are right-hand drive. Same in France. That is, wherever the British have had presence, the steering wheel of cars is on the right side. We negotiated to Saipa managers, and within 2 months, they provided right-hand drive vehicles immediately, and we sent them to Africa. And so far, they have placed an order for 15,000 cars. Or our pickup trucks are great for rural work.
Dr. Safari, can you also please explain about extraterritorial cultivation?
Extraterritorial cultivation has been discussed in Venezuela. Several thousand hectares were given to us before, but it was not followed up. But during this recent trip of the president to Latin America, an order was given. It is being followed up, but it should be within the framework of the law. For example, suppose we want to work in the field of iron ore mining. It must be within the framework of regulations. We need to respect the target country. And also, this cooperation should be win-win. We are not similar to some countries which go to African countries to loot their resources. And God is the witness that we act within the framework of the laws and regulations, and at the same time, we benefit a lot. For example, job creation. When we say that we want to bring foreign currency and realized exports, this is true. Tell you something. A series of goods must be imported from a series of specific countries. For example, aluminum powder. Our problem was that we did not use to diversify the sources of our imports that I mentioned. Someone asked me how you import currency for the country. I said it is very simple. Instead of always importing a certain product from a certain country, I import from three countries. They compete and we are the winners, or our demands. I said many times, we used to import chemical fertilizers such as potash and phosphate. Then we diversified our sources of import to four countries. Now we import it cheaper, and we did something that the previous country called us to see why we don't purchase from them anymore. We had created some fake limits. We also had little experience when it came to purchasing goods. We were always in a rush, and we would accept the conditions of the other party for self-profit and other issues, but not now. In addition, today we have launched a potash and phosphate mine in Khoran Biabanak, a county in Iran's Isfahan province. You need to go there and make a movie. Today, within a year, 800 people are working there. 400 trucks are working in the mine. These raw materials are being produced for the factory that is going to be established in the south of Iran, with excellent technology and internal and external partnerships. They claim that there is no foreign investment and the required capital is missing. But no, we see today that it is coming. And even in the case of phosphoric acid that we produce, while it requires high technology, it is the phosphoric acid that creates the potash. We travel the countries and figure out what to trade from where, for example, regarding meat. Why should our meat come from Australia in small amounts and using Emirates Airlines? We can bring from Africa. Now, the Germans, the French, Qatar, and the UAE are all importing meat from Africa. Thank God things are on track, and good follow-ups are being done, and the results are tangible.
One of the debates that is being discussed in various media of the world these days is the issue of de-dollarization from trades at the international level, especially among the BRICS countries. One of these countries is Brazil, which is actually a Latin American country. During the recent present visit to the three countries of Latin America, which you are also a member of the team, was this issue brought up about using national currencies in trade exchanges in international trades?
The national currency is the second phase, but the first phase is barter trade. See, for example, the same country you mentioned, 90% of the country whose economy hinges on agriculture need urea. Well, we have plenty of urea. We sell it to country A, and then in return, we go and bring goods from country B. Regarding Brazil, our total exports and imports are approximately $5 to $6 billion. But this year and last year, we only managed to have urea exports worth of $2 billion. We are developing this process on different products and goods. For example, India is another country that needs our urea. All African countries are in need of urea. All Latin American countries want urea. Well, if Iran intends to import rice, the path is clear. Of course, this technique is not that old. What you said is absolutely correct. This is one of our goals in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization itself, that we're looking for trades based on national currencies. And in fact, we have numerous trades with many of our neighboring countries using national currencies, whether their national currency or our national currency. Of course, there are well-defined mechanisms. We also have platforms. Most countries are like this. Figures are promising. There are many claims that it is not possible, but you don't pay attention to those talks. We are doing this now. We are also bringing foreign currency into the country. Our central bank, along with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, have a very good cooperation in this field. Recently, they had a meeting among ACU countries. In that meeting, in addition to the member states, many observers were also invited who were cooperating in this field. For example, if you want to cooperate with country A, we have a special platform for it, and your communication is done through these special platforms.
Regarding the recent visit of Mr. Raisi to three Latin American countries, we know that there are other significant countries in that region which have good political and commercial relations with Iran, such as Brazil, Bolivia, and Ecuador. Are we expecting official visits to these countries also in the near future?
Yes, there are plans for such visits. But the president, in addition to the neighboring countries, has plans to work on African countries, which, if I am correct, there are 54 of them. Maybe the number is more. Each of these countries is gold, and by gold I mean opportunity for work from both political and economic aspects. The Chinese have annual summits with their leaders. The Turks do the same, the Russians do the same, the Americans and the Europeans do the same. Therefore, it's been ordered to focus on African countries. Personally, I think that there should be more trips to African countries with the goals I mentioned. Earning currency for the country, creating jobs, exporting knowledge, exporting technical and engineering services. In an African country, you can easily get orders for mass construction projects of 15, 20, 50,000 apartments. When, for example, such a project is taken, the construction materials should also be exported there. And you open your own construction products market in that country. The same is true for medicine and equipment. We now have plans to work with some African countries in the Victoria Island, which are, I think, about 4 to 5 countries. Our technology centers are growing in African countries.
The same is happening in Latin American countries, isn't it?
Regarding the countries of Latin America, I wanted to mention that, for example, Brazil is among our target countries, and also Ecuador and Bolivia and other countries which are also interested in cooperation with Iran. We have exports to those countries, and they in fact need us.
Is there an estimate of the potential volume of trades with Latin American countries, apart from Venezuela, that you mentioned? In the first phase, we had trades of volume of $10 billion, and in the second phase, $20 billion. How much is it for the entire continent of Latin America?
In fact, if I speak of numbers, there may be some criticism against my claims, but the market is very good and rich. And by market, I don't mean just exports. If the market is capable of providing us with raw materials, it is still very beneficial. That is, if we can import iron ore, nickel, and various metals or minerals to boost our production, that is good. Why not? Let's do it. Today, our steel factories are working with 50% concentrate in the first phase. Why? Because we don't have enough iron ore. Now, some people have announced that they are ready and willing to export and sell us raw materials. We definitely welcome such suggestions. At the moment, since we are not developed in such areas, we do not have enough raw materials needed for our factories. If our factories work at full capacity, our exports will double. These materials can be easily imported from Latin American and African countries. Cuba, for example, this country is rich in nickel, and Nicaragua has a lot of silver and other metals that are needed by our industries.
Dr. Safari, what is the most important challenge you see in the way of expanding relations with Latin American countries?
The main challenge on the way to our exports and businesses, in my opinion, is shipping. This is the most important point. The president also has issued the relevant orders in this regard. Because if Iran has irregular shipping, it will improve a lot. Iran does not make the necessary parts in another country, such as a car that it then wants to assemble inside. Iran needs to create jobs here, make parts and ship them there to be fulfilled. Therefore, shipping is the most important category of our work. Now, aside from the problems in the customs area, we shouldn't ignore the importance of shipping lines. Continuity of supply of parts and raw materials required in various fields is very important. The good point is that the Iranian president has already given the necessary orders in this regard, and they are being followed up both in Africa and in Latin America.
Dr. Safari, thank you very much for giving your time. Thank you.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Limelight.
new survey has found that Britain's poorest families have endured a frightening collapse in their living standards over the past year as a result of soaring energy and food costs. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British public broadcaster, the ITV television network, has covered this story and tells us more. According to a charity survey, more than 120,000 children in the United Kingdom are living in the most extreme form of poverty. The survey suggested the situation has worsened since last year. A rise in levels of poverty has been described as stark and worrying by Buttle UK, which works with children and young people in crisis. Its survey of 1,240 frontline professionals found that some 60% of children they work with were living in destitution, up from 45% reported the previous year and 36% in 2000.